Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to this. It is your infrequent flying podcast pilot episodes. As always, I am joined by our three standard pilots, our bog standard garden variety pilots. Parco, how are you?
Bog standard. Yeah, to be honest, identical from last week. I have nothing to report.
Yeah, it's weird that we do a podcast so soon after the last one. There will be nothing to report, which is good.
I'm almost in shock. This is, you know, within a week, we're back seeing each other. Wow, unbelievable.
I know. Godders, how are you?
I'm good, enjoying a post-operational leave, which is nice. Lots of jobs to do around the house, which is maybe not so nice in the rain, but unfortunately, no fly. Ooh, I have been flying my little mini drone inside the house when I've been allowed and the dog doesn't attack it. But other than that, not so much aviation for me.
Excellent. And Dunk, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Not so much aviation for us either, because it's been a bit icy and rainy and miserable, and we're not allowed to fly in the ice and the rain. Either if the runway ices up, that's it. We're not allowed to go off it. So sadly, we've been sat on our own. But that must be the quickest introduction we've done, isn't it?
Yeah, it was approximately...
We whiz off down some rabbit hole.
It was 23 minutes shorter than the last one.
we haven't finished the intros yet, Dunk.
Exactly, yeah. Well,
has a freezing fog lifted from your runway yet?
The freezing fog.
Last week you couldn't fly because of freezing fog, I do believe.
Yeah,
That was your excuse last time. It's basically fear of flying.
It's just that James has been flying quite a lot at Cramwell. It was you that was saying we couldn't fly in it. It was me that had to remind you. No, we can take off in it, Parky. Goddess is hiding under the table.
That's handy for you, isn't it?
Goddess would be hiding under the table if it was a bit foggy. You're back in the bar somewhere because any air defender worth his salt is like, oh, it's a bit foggy out. Whilst us ground attack pilots would be launching off in it.
Yeah, absolutely lost, diverting somewhere, break the jet. Carnage.
Whilst we were sat around with not much to do, sort of waiting for the freezing fog to clear, one of the things that we were able to do was actually watch quite a lot of footage from the 30th anniversary of the Gulf War. So I know Godders was sending a lot of stuff out on that, and of course it was it's amazing that 30 years have gone by. But I guess probably the last conflict where the Royal Air Force went in properly at low level. I'm not sure about 2003 in Iraq, but certainly the 1991 Iraq Gulf War was the last time I think that we went in properly at low level. And bizarrely, sort of, I know it was a week ago, and we were talking about the fact that Godders and I joined on the 6th of January and were. Things were hotting up in the Gulf, but whilst we were polishing the brass underside of our sinks and sleeping on the floor, the boys were rushing in at low level in the tornadoes. I think we mentioned last time. I remember actually someone coming in and saying, "That's it, gone to war." And this week we're very lucky because The reason why we're doing two podcasts so close back to back is because we've got a guest, which we've been talking about for a long time. And we've just been successful in our failure, I guess, to actually get a guest. But today we've got our first guest in a long time. And I'm very pleased to introduce Nick Hurd, who flies with me at Cranwell. And I'm not going to try and do the honours and introduce him. I'm going to let him introduce himself. So, hello, Nick.
Well, good evening, Doug. Thank you. Very nice introduction. And yes, I mean, I'm quite interested to see you polishing your boots in January 1991. I have to say, if I'd been given the option at the time, I might have thought, you know, I quite fancy that right now. Yeah.
Well, it's funny, you know, perhaps if you just give us a little bit of a background about which squadron were you on at the time?
Yeah. Well, OK, so I joined the Air Force to go right back, 1981, and gone through my training. I'd done a so-called creamy tour, which meant, you know, I'd back on jet provost at Cranwell to do an instructing tour there in the sort of mid-80s. Then I got onto the Tornado in 87 and finished up, then posted to 15 Squadron, which is then based at Lahrbruck in Germany. So I joined that. So that was my second tour, but my first tour on Tornadoes was Lahrbruck in Germany, which at the time was still very much in the sort of Cold War days. You know, still very much of East versus West. We had our sort of, you know, we spent all days, you know, had lots of aeroplanes and we flew a lot and we lots of low flying around Germany. And and that was a life, you know, and very, as you know, Dunk, it's a very, you know, very social life out in Germany and very great fun, but work hard, play hard, and that's the way it was. Interesting how the situation had developed, though, because at the end of 89, the Berlin Wall came down and the Cold War effectively ended. So I think a lot of it at that time was scratching your heads thinking, well, that's it, really. Isn't what's going to happen now? So we carried on doing what we're doing in Germany for a while. And all of a sudden, in August 1990, of course, then Iraq invades Kuwait, which nobody thinks a great deal of for a day or two until it does seem to start winding up a little bit. And we start getting messages to say, well, little chaps, this is getting a bit serious and there might be a war and you might be in it, which is all of a sudden, you know, very much against what we'd all signed up for, really.
Just to stop you there, that was one of the points we made last week when Dunk and I were polishing the undersides of our sink, you know, on a bull night and the war kicked off.
Yes.
We did have, I couldn't remember how many, I think it was about 10 or 20 people actually left IoT at that point because of exactly the point you made. You know, it's not what it's up for.
Well, I remember Doug said that to me the day or two ago, and I was fascinated by that, to be absolutely honest, because I guess that's it. And strangely enough, when I'd gone through training back in 82, I was doing training at Cranwell, and the Falklands happened. And the same sort of thing came over, hang on, that's a war, isn't it? Now, I'm clearly not going to be directly involved with it right now, but all of a sudden, I did feel that the attitude sort of changed in the Air Force a bit. You know, all of a sudden it's, and certainly in 1990 it changed a bit. It's all very pleasant and jolly and all that sort of stuff. But all of a sudden it was, well, don't expect to walk away from this, chaps. You know, this is quite serious and you've got to go do it. And there's sort of very much a mindset, you know, and I'll sort of add to it. And nobody, I mean, as far as I recall, sort of taking a few steps forward here now, is bear in mind that more or less the whole sort of GO1 force, Bruggen, Lahrbruck and Marham, were all sort of worked up for this. As far as I remember, all the crews that were involved in that workup, I believe only one pilot in the midst of all that lot said he couldn't do it. He was only one pilot, I'm aware, who eventually said, you know, I can't do this. They took him off flying for a bit, spoke to the medic or the psycho, who knows what.
Send him to the Phantom?
Going to say, yeah. Dunk, you were still at IFC. It can't have been you.
No, well, he never flew a Tornado again. That was it. You know, but as far as nobody else, you know, stepped away, said I can't do this, which was a great, you know, great testament to. And I'll sort of perhaps come on to that a bit later. You know, when it actually sort of comes out for the fighting, but for the whole workup, everyone just did what they had to do, and you know, and we were all ready to go. So, but yes, but I can understand perhaps back at those, you know, IoT days when people decide that. Right then, they, yes, what am I doing this for? When this could happen, I'll step out and do something else.
What was the feeling on the squadron, though, when you sort of got that, you know, the info started to come through that suddenly this is a, you know, one of the most advanced air forces in the world, and suddenly you're going to be going up against it with heavily defended ground targets. Was the feeling you know, a palpable excitement? Was it, you know, were you, was there, well, clearly that one bloke was crapping himself, wasn't he? But I guess, you know, there was probably a mix of feelings. How did you feel?
Well, I don't know. I started paying a bit more attention to EW lessons for a start, you know. Start listening, oh my God, what's that radar? What's that SAM? You know, and how do I counter that one? That sort of became more of an interest, shall we say.
I imagine it focuses the mind a bit.
Well, more than anything, you know. And when they start saying, oh, by the way, you have written your will, haven't you? And you have got this, everything's prepared, you know, everything's sorted.
Yeah.
And you think, my goodness me, this really is getting quite serious, isn't it? I mean, I do recall one strange day. I think it probably was late in the August of that, August 1990, when things were sort of settling down a bit. Well, not settling down, you know, no one really knew what was going on. And I think I was running, you know, doing the desk one day on the squadron. And it started off in the morning that it was sort of, there was a sort of gentle call from the operations centre saying, just how many crews do you have at the moment on 15? Who's on leave? And, you know, it was August, people are on leave and all this sort of stuff. So I come back and say, oh, we've got about, you know, 8.5 crews or something, you know. And then about by lunchtime, it was, okay, get all those crews together, tell them to pack their bags, they're going to the Middle East tomorrow, we don't know where, and we don't know when they're coming back. So it was all sort of wound up into mayhem. And then by tea time, it was always, in a classic military way, oh, forget all that, no, you're not going anywhere, just stand down again. And it all went in the space of a day of you know, whipping up to mayhem and down again. So, strange sort of day.
And I guess one of the points there, Nick, is, you know, but anyone who's listening who's done it in recent years, you know, because clearly the last 20 years have been pretty busy in the military. Yeah. But at that point, we were a non-deployable military, if you like. You know, you were there in Germany to take out those sort of fixed targets. So you didn't have a bag in the loft with all your stuff ready to go. You know, you probably weren't weapons trained in terms of a personal weapon or those sorts of things, or gas masks, or, you know, you may well have been for the sort of the nuclear, biological and chemical role. But it wouldn't have been easy. You know, you'd have been thrashing around wondering what to take, I guess.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, we didn't deploy. You know, we went to Deshi for a couple of weeks. We went to Goose Bay and all this sort of stuff. But we weren't routinely deploying places. I mean, for example, Germany crews, we weren't tanker qualified. We didn't go tanking.
Why?
Because we didn't, you know, we weren't, all we had to do, as you say, we had to go to East Germany, trash an airfield and come back. That was our job. So Marron squadrons did do tanking, but we didn't. And that was a major part of the training upgrade for Germany squadrons, was to go learn how to tank. I mean, me being sort of, by then, a sort of squadron QFI, having never tanked, it took me about, I think, a fortnight from going from never having tanked to being a day-night rear seat qualified air-to-air refueling instructor. Because that's the way it was, you know, that we had no one else to do. I sort of had to go in the front seat daytime and had to go in the back seat daytime and then did it all at night. And that was it. Oh, Nick, that's it. You've got to go off and do all the pilots now, you know, at night in the back seat. Oh, thanks very much. Yeah, so it's all part of the sort of mayhem and sort of, you know, we just weren't ready for this at all in many ways.
So can I just ask about your workup then? When you're in Germany, you obviously very prepared to do a single thing. Like you said, then you're going to go over and trash an airfield. How similar was what you were expected to do in the Gulf to what you were trained to do in Germany?
Well, in fairness, it was reasonably good. You know, in that we were still essentially aiming for a sort of a low flying war. Now, you know, we'll come on to that later, as whether that was actually such a good idea or not. But our main job was you know, to go and attack East German airfields with this new weapon, this JP-233 weapon, this runway attack weapon. So, which is designed to be dropped over an airfield at 200 feet, you know, and that's what you have to do. So we spent our time doing that, or we do attack, you know, we're doing attacks with 1,000-pound bombs or this, that, and the other. But essentially, we were still low flying. So we were doing a sort of nighttime. We would do TFR training, you know, terrain following radar training. So in many ways, it was, you know, it was good. It was appropriate. But there were still lots of things that we didn't know how to do, you know, and like I say, tanking was, in particular, was one of them. And then having learned how to tank, then training the bladder to sort of last for 4 hours rather than an hour and a half, you know, just things like that had to be sorted out. there was still a lot of new stuff, but we weren't completely, and in fairness, I mean, perhaps in those days, Germany squadrons, I think we were seen as, you know, that was the front line, and probably on the Tornado force, we or the GO1 force, we were certainly seen, you know, that was, we were the boys sort of thing, and probably we were the best out there, because we did sort of, you know, we did probably worked hardest and played, we had more exercises, all that sort of stuff, you know, and it kept you pretty sharp.
So how long, Nick, from getting the nod that, you know, you're going to now deploy, was it fairly quick again and, you know, tanked the jets out and that was it? You were off?
Well, no, eventually things settled down a bit, and eventually some jets did deploy quite quickly. Now, eventually it was Bruggen Wing that sort of seemed to get involved earlier on. I mean, an interesting sort of mistake the Air Force made, again, coming back to this idea of not knowing how to deploy. Their airships at the time decided, oh, my goodness, with this going on, we've got to send some Tornadoes down. Who should we send? Well, we'll send Bruggen Wing, but we'll cherry pick all these sort of fours leaders, pairs leaders, QYs, and send them all down to sort of form the first sort of wave. Now, that was a complete and utter disaster, you know, because you've got four squadrons with different sort of, you know, everyone who's got a different idea, they've all got slightly different tactics. There's lots of, but of course, everyone's got their own slightly different ideas, all pulling different directions. And it was such a disaster to start with.
Just from experience, Nick, I totally agree. So for the boys that don't know, QY, that's the Qualified Weapons Instructor.
Sorry, yes, of course, yeah.
And if you ever want to have an argument, probably get three Harrier, I would suggest, weapons instructors, but get them in a room together, and they just disagree on everything. I mean, yes. I do know what you mean. There's just, and they're always done. Right.
Marky, as a Harrier QY, I never argued.
He did.
That's so interesting. So, yeah, so how did the different squadrons evolve? So how did the different squadrons evolve? I would have assumed, as a complete outsider looking in, that you all had common practice and that you all worked from the same manual.
Well, that's
so you
yes.
think, JB.
And that's yes, just to a large extent there is, but there's just always the little quirks and different ideas to sort of say, well, we should attack this way or this, that, the other. Eventually, the Air Force sort of they quickly got the idea that was not a good thing to do. And then, hey, why don't we send squadrons down? That's what we have squadrons for. You know, and because then you've got the right balance of people, and you know you've got half the squadron who'll just, you know, as you want, who'll just do what they're told. You know, they'll just, you point them at the right target, and they'll go and do the job without arguing. They'll go and do it. So it finally settled down to a proper squadron rule, squadron rotation. So then, you know, and then a plan actually came out, and then we got slated to go out in sort of November of 1990, basically, to sort of replace one of the Bruggen, I think, seven, I can't remember, one of the Bruggen squadrons. And although at the time, you know, by then, of course, if you recall, there was this deadline on by then, the United Nations deadline, the 15th of January, for Saddam to leave Kuwait. And we were sort of deployed in November with no fixed date for return, but kind of then thinking, right, okay, well, if it all happens on the 15th or 16th of January, I think we're going to be there. So there we are. And we deployed to Bahrain. Of course, we had jets in, you know, to Bahrain and Dharan and then Tobruk over on the west side of Saudi. But I was very happy to go to Bahrain because that means we got put in the Sheraton Hotel, which, you know, I didn't argue with at all. And
that's the way to go to war.
Absolutely.
How the Air Force should go to war, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. If we do get any Army or Navy listeners... who always, always rag the Royal Air Force for Samsonite suitcases and hotels. Well, you know, it is the way to go to war. Well, I'm not going to lie.
Well, Parky Jr.'s in the Army, so, you know, he should be listening, shouldn't he?
Do
you make him listen, Parky?
He's out in the garden in a tent.
I've got to say, Nick, yeah. I'm really, really finding that part about taking apart the squadrons in squadrons interesting. What would then happen with the remainder of the squadron? Would it just be gutted of its senior and experienced people?
I think that's kind of what happened. Like I said, it was Bruggen, so I didn't really see it happening directly because that was the other base. Larbrook, we were sort of left alone for a little while. But yeah, so not only that, they sort of clean out all their, so they left a bit sort of lacking in supervision on those squadrons as well. So it was a daft sort of way of doing things, really. It was just a knee-jerk reaction, I think, to say, oh, we, you know, that, I guess they were, you know, concerned that, you know, politically we've got to get the right, you know, we must get the very best people down there. So let's just do that and that'll be fine. But it all settled down and we got things properly sorted out and we painted squadrons again and it worked much better.
Now, one of the really cool-looking aircraft, I think, is the Gulf War Tornadoes. When did you receive those paint jobs? And were you pretty happy with them?
Yeah, that happened quite... Yeah, that came quite quickly, actually. We started... They sort of became known as Desert Pink.
Yeah. They weren't pink, though, were they?
So... But they started even in the Germany jets were still getting painted up as well. So it wasn't just because the jets were essentially a bunch of jets were taken down and left in theatre. But there was always a rotation of jets as well, of course, as there always is. But I think a lot of us thought that was all decent enough. And in fact, of course, then when the war started, what did start happening, of course, as ground crew do, they start painting on them, and we start getting some of that nice. That you see, and they started painting bombs on the side for a number of missions that jets done and all this sort of stuff. So all the great traditions sort of carried on, which is really good to see.
And what did you do? Sorry, Parky, what did you do sort of clearly out there in November, as you say, but it didn't kick off proper like until middle of January.
Yeah.
So how were you training and what were you doing and what was the clearly... You know that you're on a war footing. What were you doing? How were you getting ready to go and do what you were going to do?
Well, the missions we did a lot of. We had sort of two main areas that we could train in. We could go to fly around the Saudi desert. We didn't particularly like that because there was kind of nothing there. And we knew Iraq was going to be a little bit different, sort of from the scenery point of view. So we spent more time doing trips in down to Oman. And that was pretty good because that sort of gave us more of a reflection of how long the trips would be, because Oman was about an hour and a half away, so we had to take off. We'd meet up with a tanker, a VC-10 or Victor in those days, trail down with the tanker, let off from the tanker, did spend an hour low flying around Oman, where there's a bit more stuff to go for and attack and all this sort of stuff. Then we could pull up, meet up with the tanker again, come home, and that whole thing came to about 4 hours. Which is very representative of the sort of length of trips we started.
Yeah.
So in fact, that was pretty good. There was no bombing range there, unfortunately. We couldn't drop any bombs, but at least we could do everything else, and we could do evasion and all the usual stuff. Fighter evasion, and that was pretty good. And we could do that night, day or night. So that was pretty good sort of training. Yeah.
Nick, when one of the things that we've been talking about in the last week was John Nicholas has put a lot of really good stuff actually on Twitter about the sort of workup and the stuff that you're doing. I got into a conversation with him the other week about low flying, because actually one of the crews that were, I think they were from 14 Squadron, had gone in. Two of the guys were killed, the young guys, I think, because Duncan I's our flight commander had been on 14 Squadron and then had come to initial officer training, and was pretty cut up about the this at the time when the guys had flown in. And that was your classic, but it was, hey, look how low we can go, and possibly filming the shadow kind of thing. Clearly all of us at the time and subsequently as well have seen a huge amount of video or photos of some incredibly low flying. And so at that time, had the, we're generally cleared to operationally low fly at 100 feet. Had the rules gone out the window, or were you very specifically briefed to drop lower in the during the daytime during that training period?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think when they, I seem to recall again when the first teams did turn up in the Middle East, they basically went to sort of no rules whatsoever. We'll fly as low as we like, and that's that. But then I think when things settled down a bit, they did start saying, this is not, we must have some rules. So they started saying, not below 100 feet over the desert, something like that, So, and that's the way, and that was reasonable enough. And I was happy enough to work to that. And all right, probably like all of us, we trained at operation low flying, and how you sort of get better at it as you do it for a little bit longer. And I was, I think I eventually got settled down about, we all talk about probably the height that you're happy with. I was probably puts it about 130 feet or so, I reckon. I could fly around all day at 130 feet, looking around and doing other things, and occasionally go down a bit lower if I really had to. But, I mean, the Tornado was really good for low flying, in fairness. It was a super aeroplane for that. It had perfect wing loading, the wings back and everything. It was just superbly stable. I had a trip in an F-16 once, I remember, around the Lake District years later,
Rubbish.
Two seniors.
Yeah, absolutely gutless, Nick.
Do you know what?
Bored you.
It is fantastic to have you on to talk about the golf. But that has just, I have to listen to these two boys bang on about how wonderful the F-16 is, morning, noon, and night. So to hear you come in and say, it was not quite all it was cracked up to be has just made my evening.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed being as a Dutch one. I was a two-seater sitting in the back, but we flew around. They wanted to go flying around the Lake District, which we did. It's like, well, I'm going to say, Dunk, it's like being in, you know, in the prefect at low level, you know, in bumpy conditions. My teeth nearly fell out, I think, with all the bumping around this F-16. So I thought, yes, I think a tornado does this a little better, actually.
I'm off. It's been great meeting you, Nick.
Hey, I think the F-16 turned. Was it 41 this week?
Yeah, I bet.
Probably. 70s,
I know, is that the 70s? Yeah, late 70s.
Brilliant. Let's bin this Gulf War nonsense and talk about the F-16.
Nick, were you, did you split into sort of day and night crews in that training period, and were you always going to stick to them, or did you swap around between day flying and night flying?
Well, we were crewed up, obviously crewed up entirely there with pilot and navigator were crewed up, so in fact, you know, sharing rooms in the hotel, I mean, that was pretty hellish, you know, it was, you know, share a room for God's sake, you know, so we were paired up like that, but then we were also constituted four ships as well, so we were flying just as we had that many people, but so effectively each squadron had sort of four ships of crews, you know, so, and we just carried on flying like that. So I was routinely the number two to my boss, actually, John Broadbent, and Nigel Isdale was a, and I just spent, you know, just, we just flew around like that all the time, which is great, you know, because I mean, you know, again, you know how it is, you just sort of build up a little rapport within your four ship, you know how things go, and it just sort of works nicely. So, and that's the way it was, right up until the war and during the war itself. Although we might have got bigger.
Do you think that made a difference? Because, you know, whenever I have flown sort of constituted, I've not flown a two-seat aeroplane, but, you know, constituted two ships or four ships, it really does make a difference after a week when you really start understanding each other. You know, you know what they're thinking, you know how they, you know when, you know, when they're going to do things. Do you think that made a difference when it actually came to crossing the line on night one?
Yeah, I think unquestionable. Yeah, so a constituted four ship or whatever is the way to go. I mean, I think routinely for us on the squadron, we didn't fly like that for day to day operations. You know, day to day, you know, like normal flying, we didn't, because it was just too difficult. You know, it is, it's always up on the way and leave and next and this, that and the other. So that wasn't the case. But certainly now, when no one's going away, you know, we're all there together, then putting it together as four ships was absolutely way to go. And yes, we all felt,
can I just ask
I
a quick,
we felt pretty good.
Can I just ask a quick question? And all of you, please jump in on this. Why is a four ship the way to go? It seems to be a bit of a consensus there as to that seems to be a particularly good idea.
Go ahead, Nick.
No, you go ahead. No,
I was just going to say, there's a... The sort of minimum that you fly around in JB is a two ship, where, you know, ultimately it is about, it comes from way back in, you know, they did an element of this in the First World War, but Second World War, the way the Germans ended up flying. But the sort of what we term battle formation, where there is, you fly about a mile and a half, mile to 2 miles apart, because just purely in terms of lookout, looking out of the window, you can cover the 6 o'clock and below and behind the other aeroplane when you are flying a bit wider apart. If you fly, when you're visual, if you fly too wide, you kind of lose, you know, you're now finding it difficult to see the other guy. But we do fly like that these days because you've got all sorts of helmet systems that allow you to see the other person. You know, you call it detached mutual support. So you've got that two ship together. But if you are then looking to mass firepower, whether it's in the bombing role that Nick will talk about in a minute, or in the air-to-air role, you know, certainly in the air-to-air role, you have got a lot more options available to you. You can imagine with a four ship, you can either sit together in what's called a wall formation and just cover a large portion of airspace, or you can split into two twos and kind of go counter rotating, which means you've always got radars downrange. And then there's reasons for doing that in the bomb dropping world as well, in terms of that massing firepower and moving formations around the place.
Oh, brilliant.
So a four ship means that the guys at the front, the two guys at the front, and you generally call it card. So you'd fly in a box of aircraft. So the pair, exactly as God has just described, the pair at the front, and then you might have the pair at the back offset to try and stop it being easy for enemy radars to just go, oh, there's the front pair, there's the back pair. So you might sit offset. But the idea is to try and if fighters were going to drop in behind the front pair, then the rear pair can have at those fighters trying to molest the front two guys. So tactically, it's a very defensive formation. Well, I suppose it's defense offense, isn't it? You know, it's a bit of both, and it comes from a long time and learning lessons the hard way, really, as God has said back in as far back as World War One, but certainly World War Two.
And even with air-to-air threats that are beyond visual range, and as God has said, you know, things have moved on from fighters dropping in behind. You know, weapons have massively improved, but it's just still a very versatile user. It just a four ship works, that, and it still does.
Yeah, I just had to say, on the GR1 force at the time, we were flying four ships, but for nighttime, effectively, we're still doing the same thing. We're still flying that sort of card formation that we sort of talked about, but we call this, this is a so-called parallel track operation came in, where basically, you know, a pair would fly just you know, effectively what you would otherwise do day visually, but, you know, is flying as a number two, but that number two has its own sort of line on a map. It's a separate route, which is, this is where the navigators sort of have sort of, you know, headaches as they sort of try and put their plans together. To make sure that, so basically you would fly this, you know, usual, as you say, sort of perhaps 2 miles apart, something like that, with just flying separate tracks like that. And we could do that, you know, night or IMC. And in fact, you know, now if we do it in peacetime, we would do that sort of day, could do it night or day VMC, but of course you could see the other guy, which is all fine. At nighttime, you can see his lights, and that was all fine. We could do also, and then we went to Goose Bay, for example, training, we would do that IMC, you know, in cloud, because weather in Canada was often like that, and you're often not, you know, that's where you couldn't see the other aeroplane. As you're flying around at, you know, 500 feet on the TFR, you might occasionally sort of see him as you drop down to a valley and look across, and there he is over there, and then you sort of pop back up into the cloud again and lose him again, and we just sort of carry on like that. And it's very much very sort of disciplined thing. If you must be, you had to be on your track, and in particular there's very hard rules about timing, basically, is that if you are not, you know, on track, on time, on speed, and, you know, probably like plus or minus 5 seconds, then you had to get out of it, because you were therefore becoming an issue for, not necessarily for the guy behind, you know, to the left of you, but for guys behind you, because then we would have another pair coming, you know, 30 seconds behind. And that's how we were flying on our first operational missions in the Gulf.
So you've mentioned it. You mentioned TFR. Just explain for those that might not know what TFR is.
Yes, so this is the terrain following radar system, which had been fitted to the, it was the same system as fitted to the F-111. So it was a real 1970s sort of technology, but actually a remarkably good piece of kit. It was a forward-looking radar, basically, which the aim of which was to allow the aircraft to fly beyond autopilot or manually, and just avoid the ground. It would look ahead about 7 miles or so, and it could just detect clearly the ground sort of coming up, and therefore would command the autopilot system to, you know, for the aircraft to therefore climb over the top of any terrain, and then when it cleared that terrain, it would then drop it down over the other side. And it's sort of a major part of tornado training, perhaps early days even, was actually getting confidence in this, because a lot of people suck their teeth when they hear this, and actually sort of realise we were doing this at, you know, peacetime, sort of 500 feet, but, you know, for real, as we did, it went down to 200 feet. That's as low as the switch would take you. Which is, as we know, is pretty close to the ground. You know, to be sitting there on autopilot, as we would tend to do, with George flying it for you. But it's actually a remarkably reliable system. It could be trusted.
So you called it George. That was the nickname.
Well, we didn't actually. I mean, I would say that that was a sort of classic World War II autopilot word, wasn't it? For George. Actually, you know, for nighttime operations, we would fly with the autopilot in, which sounds a bit alien to fast jet pilots. But but we would, and there's quite a good reason, because it was so good. But of course, that meant it would follow all the commands correctly. So if it's terrain coming, it would fly. Whereas if, of course, you were flying it manually and you're a bit distracted and not looking where you're going, because you can't, because it's nighttime and you didn't have night vision goggles, you would fly into the ground. So you tend to fly in autopilot, unless there's a good reason not to, like dropping weapons, in fact. And then the autopilot would go back in again, but perhaps we'll come on to that a bit later.
Well, yeah. Nick, there you are in the week coming up through or maybe it's the week before the 15th. You know, you're practicing low level stuff, whether it be lofting 1,000-pounders, whether it's dropping high drag 1,000-pounders, or whether it's JP233. Did you know though that was the sort of target that you were going to be put up against, the sort of airfield targets, or was there a point in the planning where, you know, a bit like the curtain goes back and they say Dresden tonight, that you were read into exactly what the plan was?
Yeah, it was more like that, in fairness, in that we weren't, you know, when it came to planning, when I turned up for sort of, you know, the first night, as I did on the first wave, you know, I turned up for work, you know, we know the deadline's gone by, but we still don't know if it's going all happening tonight. And yet it is, we are, you know, given maps that night to say, chaps, here's your target for tonight. It's Tallil Airfield. And that's the first we knew of it, because it all been planned by, again, those QYs again, it all got together and drawn the maps and all this sort of stuff. And they just basically, you know, gave them to us, which is fine. You know, we knew what we were doing, and it was just...
Excited, you know. Or do you get that feeling in the pit of your stomach?
I was not excited at all. Quite the reverse. I don't know if I've been fatalistic. I mean, it wasn't a big surprise, in fairness. So when it turned up and said, well, it is starting tonight, well, all right, that doesn't come as a big surprise. But at the same time, I don't know, I'm not quite sure how I sort of felt, but certainly probably scared more than anything, I think, you know, and oh my God, I can't believe I'm mixed up with this now. And this is, because I think it's going to be quite a big deal, I think.
Yeah, and had you had intelligence briefs leading up to that in terms of the order of battle in Iraq? Did you know Tallil as a heavily defended airfield with a lot of capability there at all?
No, in fairness, I didn't know anything about specific targets in Iraq at all, I might say. You know, we knew all about, we knew their air force and we knew their defences and all that sort of stuff. But in terms of actual places we might go to, we hadn't done any of that, which is probably quite a, possibly a bit of a failing, I don't know. But then again, need to know and all this sort of stuff, you know, if we knew about it before and, you know, air crew, they, you know, if we knew too much and then got captured, you know, what we're like, we get, you know, it takes 10 seconds before we start talking, doesn't it, really? You know?
They bring the comfy chair in, and that's
the sharpened guava half.
We're spilling. I mean, that is a really good point about the secrecy side of things, which is why I asked the question. You know, you know, curtain goes back, and you know whether it's Dresden, I can't imagine the way you all looked at each other on that evening when you walk in and go, this is it, boys. And I'll hand over to Parky in a sec, but I retweeted something. I think it was John Nicol had tweeted it, but there's a Twitter site called the Ops Room, I think it is, which puts together animated, you know, little airplanes on a map of various efforts, campaigns and things across history since we've been flying. And they put together night one, January the 15th, in 91. And when you look at the, you know, there's multiple carriers in the Red Sea, in the Gulf, B-52s coming from the US, TLAMs, cruise missiles coming off multiple ships in around the areas, 117s off into Baghdad, you know, and it's really interesting to me that there you are, you turn up to work, here's your target, and no idea realistically that any of this stuff is going on around you or has been planned for weeks and months.
And I suppose even then I don't recall being briefed very much on, you know, what else is going on. You sort of make a bit of a guess, you know, but yeah, there's probably a lot else going on. And of course, you know, you might see that on a screen or a board or something. You might think, wow, the sky looks full. And of course, you fly your own little trip, you don't see any of that. You just fly your own little bit of sky, albeit we were the only people stupid enough to be down at 200 feet. But, you know, everyone else is messing around in a far more sensible place. But But no, it, you know, you saw, and everyone else is lights off, so you don't see a thing. You know, you hear people on the radio, but you know how it is. You just really don't see anybody else. In fact, I recall, not just the first night, but, you know, several nights, well, certainly nighttime in particular, when I'm there, you know, we turned off all the lights, we crossed the border, and that's it. I can't see anyone else in the formation now. I'm at the front anyway with, you know, my leader there, but that's it. And I kind of thought, I feel quite lonely here. I've got a back seater, but I can't really see him, you know, and I'm just sat here by myself. And
did you talk to him at all?
Yes, I was. Yes.
Only if you had to.
There's a lot of chat. We had this sort of commentary went backwards and forwards with this TFR stuff, you know, because he had the sort of longer range radar, so he could sort of see the ground a bit further, and we'd talk ourselves down to any terrain coming up. So there's a lot of chat going on, of course, you know. But I remember sitting there thinking, I do feel quite lonely here. It's my little pink body here.
So Nick, you know, you that first night you brief up, you step, you walk for your jet. I guess it's night to that stage.
Yeah.
You know, that's slightly surreal. This is it. You're off. And there you go. I mean, I imagine just, you know, adrenaline, nerves, everything you've just mentioned. But you've got a tank. It's a long, you know, just for the nerves to keep building and building. And then you're into that run. You descend down it's happening. You are now going to go through this airfield. Just chat me through. Is it still vivid, the memories of that?
Yeah. Yes, and I was speaking to one of the other guys recently. I think, and all of us say, there's not a day goes by when we don't think about it, really. None of us, I think. We all think about it every day, about, you know, how it went and everything. But anyway, so there we are. Let me just sort of take you through, because one or two sort of little surreal things happen that first night, you know, because it is, we realise it was, you know, it was going to be probably the biggest thing since, I don't know, possibly the Second World War, I guess, in terms of a single package of, you know, so we thought, this is a big deal. So we walked to the jets pretty early, as you do on the tornado, because there's always glitches and things like that. So we jump in, and
sorry to interrupt. Yes. But can you just, before you go into that, what were you actually dropping on that first night?
So, yeah, so we were attacking this airfield called Talil, which was an Iraqi fighter base in the southern part of Iraq. Two sort of 10,000-foot parallel runways, about the size of Heathrow, you know. And our job was going to be an 8-ship of tornadoes, each of which is carrying two of these JP-233 weapons. Each pair of JP-233, so each tornado is carrying 60 of these runway cratering charges. They're the things that they sort of came down on the parachute. And then also we were all scattering 400 of these little sort of little mines, those little baked bean tin size mines. And so that was the idea was to sort of discourage clearing up afterwards. So this JP-233 sort of parachute charge had two charges in it. The idea was that the first charge blows it into the ground, and then the second charge goes off pretty well instantaneously to then sort of heave up runway concrete from below. So we get that sort of effect. You know, as you'll know, if you drop £1,000 onto a runway, it creates a hole, but you just fill in the hole and it's a runway again. So the idea of this JP-233 was this sort of double charge. So our idea, so that was the idea, that was the, that's what our thing, that which therefore meant we were going to go through over this airfield at 200 feet to drop this weapon. So that was all briefed, and, you know, and like I say, it was going to be an 8-ship, so two of our 2 4-ships together.
Sorry, Nick, yeah. On the JP-233, was that the first time you dropped one? The reason I ask that is I don't understand how else you would drop it, because you can't, like you pointed out before, in peacetime, you couldn't really clean it up because it was just anti-personnel mines.
Yep. No, it was the first time for all of us. So there was no way. We'd have practice. We had it in the simulator. Our simulator in those days was a very basic thing. So we could practice it in the simulator, and we get this sort of little rumbling effect, you know, as these. Because it took about 5-6 seconds for all the bomblets to come off. And then, in fact, the canisters at the end would automatically fall off as well. So the big thump, four thumps at the end as they would come off as well. So that would take about 5-6 seconds altogether. But no, we hadn't practiced for real. But in fairness, we didn't really have to. We were, it would have been nice, perhaps. There's absolutely no way we could do that, because it's just too dangerous a weapon to do that, as you rightly point out. We went out to the jets very early, probably about an hour before takeoff. And as it was, I think we climbed in the jet and got it going, and jet was fine. So then we had about 3/4 of an hour. We just sat there, you know, waiting to go. And it was just, felt like a long time. You know, oh my goodness me, what now? You know, and you start. Anyway, there's nothing else. Anyway, and we take off, and then okay, and off we go. And I don't know if my backseat, I mean, we got airborne, and just said to me, "Well, Nick, we're off." You know, yeah, I guess we are, aren't we? You know. So anyway, so we met up with the tankers, and we had again. We were going to have the routing. If you sort of think of the, you know, where Bahrain is, the we could have gone straight up the Gulf, but I think we didn't like that. That's sort of quite a sort of hot territory, Basra and Shida, those sort of places. We didn't like that. So we met up with tankers and then went up to the northwest in Saudi airspace for a good hour and a half or so to then sort of let down into Iraq along that southern border with Saudi Arabia, which is much, much quieter. So therefore, we had quite a long time sitting with the tankers. And so that's it. We our front four ship, we met up with the tankers, or I can't remember the Victors or VC-10s, and we... And just sitting there, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, because the idea was that we were attacking about four in the morning, i.e. just before it gets light, and then we'd be landing at six in the morning, something when it's daylight again. The idea being is that we then shut down the airfield for the sort of daytime hours, because we knew they weren't going to fly very much at night. So that's the idea. So it's nighttime, met up with the tankers, and there we are, so cruising along. It's not easy. The JP3 is very heavy, and we were actually a bit slightly above max takeoff weight on with the big tanks fitted and things like that. We're about half a ton over max takeoff weight, which we'd spotted some months before, and British Aerospace said, "Oh, it'll be all right. Don't worry about it." So we pressed. Well, that's fine. That was main, because the 2250-litre tanks had been brought in because we needed the fuel. And we were very, well, we don't care. We need the fuel. So, yeah, we don't. Anyway, so anyway, off we go. So the jet was really heavy, and it was very hard work tanking. It was mushing around and pretty hard work. And anyway... But at the same, we settled down. We took some fuel and filled up and carried on down route for a bit. And then we've got an HF radio on the Tornado, which we couldn't transmit on, would you believe, because it affected the controls. Ridiculous, but we could listen. We could listen to the World Service of all things. So there we are. My Bexeter tunes into the World Service, BBC World Service. You know, we're sort of thinking, well, I bet they've got something going on here. And there's nothing going on. And the World Service sort of got that. I forget what the program was, but it's something very benign. It was like, you know, gardening question time or something. And we're sat here, you know, thinking, this is incredible. I'm sat here. I'm about to start a war with a lot of other people, and I'm listening to this on the radio, and it's that's it, surreal. Anyway, it didn't last very long before all of a sudden it was, you know, we interrupt this program to go to the newsroom, and you know, and then they start reporting of explosions in Baghdad, which, you know, as you say, you got cruise missiles were starting to hit and things like that, you know. So we thought, oh right, the game is on. So
I don't suppose you remember any of the news stories prior to the breaking news, do you?
Say again, sorry.
I don't suppose you remember any of the news stories prior to the breaking news.
Oh, no, I don't. No. It was just something, you know. I don't know what he said, but you know, it was good. At which point we turned the World Service off. We thought, no, we don't need that anymore. But then after that, I mean, I sort of thought about these little moments of them having, you know, we then sort of took some more fuel, found a bit of fuel, and then left the tankers. I mean, sort of set ourselves up to let down to low level, and we're probably sort of, I don't know, 40 odd miles south of the Iraqi border at this point. And then we sort of start heading northwards and letting down to low level in our separate sort of, this is where we set up this parallel track bit. So we had to get ourselves on time and everything. So we do that. And then, as you know, GL1 had a big moving map display, you know, between our knees. And I remember then, once we settled down to low level, and then I see, you know, the border is shown on the moving map there. And it's, you know, I always remember just seeing on sort of one side, it says Saudi Arabia. On the other side, it says Iraq. And, as I cross that border, and here I am, that's it, 420 knots, 200 feet on the TFR. I've got 4.5 tons of bombs. I've got two Sidewinder missiles. I've got two Mauser cannon all armed up. This is offensive. They can do what they like. They can shoot back at me any time now because this is clearly an offensive act. And I just thought, bloody hell, this is getting very serious now. I think it's time to call all this off, really. but that was it. It was dead. It was actually dead quiet. In fact, there was nothing going on down there. We could start to see explosions and stuff going on in the distance, you know. So, but we had our quite little bit of desert there, so that was all quite nice. And that was all. And then it was about 15. Probably 15 minutes or 15, 20 minutes or so to the airfield, to the target. So not too long. And that's when it sort of, you know, then things started happening is that, and the jet's flying on these sort of, this fixed route and these fixed turning points. And I sort of recall then as sort of we're getting, you know, we know we get close to the target area. It's a very clear night. And I see this towards the sort of, you know, 10:30 position off on the left. I sort of look to the left and see this massive area of AAA, of anti-aircraft fire coming up. And it's at nighttime, it is just, and it was so intense and you know, flashing up in the speed of it and everything. You think, bloody hell. I looked at that and thought, holy, look at that. I wonder what that is. I wouldn't want to go into that. Well, just then the jet gets to a turning point. The light is on autopilot and it turns left and points right at it. And it suddenly becomes clear. Holy shit, that's where I'm going, isn't it? Of course. And this is the airfield. I've got a bit of the old nighttime sort of distance compression bit of sort of, and it was closed and that was it. And I thought, oh my God. And of course, and it's not surprising they were shooting because they had been visited by those very same B-52s and F-117s and F-111s that we'd all, you know, had, except they'd all gone in there first, as required. And we were going in last, the reason being because we had these mines. And, it, you know, we didn't want people coming after us because they'd set off our mine, which, of course, we didn't really want. So we were last in. So, therefore, the defences were up and running big time.
So they really lucked in there, Nick.
Yeah, that was a great deal. Great,
so they poked the hornet's nest and then in you went.
Absolutely. And I, you know, I say this, and, of course, there are never any pictures of this, so I sort of, you know, I have to describe it, but... You know, the intensity of all this triple at night time when we knew this thing, you know, we all know ZSU-23-4s and S-60s and things like that, all pumping out, you know, very high velocity and extraordinary high velocity, you know, stuff out there. And it just, I sort of do this thing with my fingers and sort of say, it looked like a sort of mesh of AAA. And I just looked at it and I thought, I'm a dead man. I'm not going to, there's no way through that. That looks just like a complete, you know, complete unmissable bunch of high velocity stuff and that was it. And now there we go. So we're running into time.
Wow.
Did anyone turn round at that point?
Well, now there's a good question. And that was it. And at this, you know, and I also come back to this and on that, I know not on that night, everybody, certainly on our eight ship, everybody just went through it. Everybody just did it. And it comes back to that sort of military thing that any of you guys have done, you would have done, I have no doubt you would have done it as well. Because first and foremost, you don't want to be the one who cocks up, who says, I can't do it. If all those years of training, you would have done just the same. I sort of content, you know, say that to anybody who's been in the military for a few years. You would have just done it. And I did. I just didn't think at all of, I cannot possibly do that. I just got to get my head down and go through it.
Did anyone say anything over the radio? Did you talk into cockpit oh God!
Between there was absolutely complete radio silence amongst the, you know, there's nobody talking. We didn't have to, so there's no talk between aircraft, front and back. You know, again, I'm not quite sure what I don't. I think we've just seen a bit of a stunned, terrified silence. Really, obviously, the back seat of Rob Woods is there. He was sitting in the back. I mean, he's got a little bit of distraction. He's head down, sort of looking at his radar and doing his stuff on that. And all he had to do, in fact, was because we were bombing in what's sort of offset mode, all he had to do was find the corner of a fence. Basically, these massive airfields, that they had massive big fences around them, which put a beautiful 90-degree corner, which is fantastically radar significant. So the backseat, all he had to do was find that, and then we'd already planned, you know, the bombing, the bombs would drop in the right place then. In offset mode, so he was sort of, I think, happy to be looking at something else. Whereas all I was looking at was looking more at a straight ahead, thinking, "Bloody hell, this is not good." I don't know.
There was nothing there saying, "Rob, whatever you do, do not look up."
I mean, it was just impossible not to see it because it was just astonishing, and it seemed to. And I remember sort of seeing when we finally sort of went into it. You know, I thought, and I still haven't quite worked out how it happened because, you know, I seem to be in it for so long, long before I was actually over the airfield perimeter. I seem to be in this AAA. And it's, you know, it's quite bizarre how I remember seeing guns open up as I literally going past them and just, you know, just literally opening up. And I think that guy's probably about 80 yards away from me, you know, and I was just, and I'm sat in and a complete, and of course, and I can't hear anything. You just sat there in this warm cockpit, warm, quiet cockpit. There must be the noise on the airfield itself must be incredible, you know. And the only thing I did notice, unfortunately, was that there was nothing showing at all on the radar warning receiver.
I was going to ask that about SAMs. Yeah.
Yes. So now, of course, because we have got We have got anti-radar missile shooter. We've got Wild Weasel, you know, the probably F-4s, I think, or F-16s, you know, with the anti-radar missiles who are, you know, hovering around. They're with our package, so they're sort of waiting to shoot. We've got EF-111 Ravens who are doing their jamming thing and things like that. So we had support. And I think the word is out, and the Iraqis were very cautious about that. So therefore, they just kept the radars off and just hosed away with the guns.
Ah, so this is going to be one of my questions.
Yeah.
In fact, I raised it last week, which was, you know, when you watch these videos, for instance, of naval ships, and they've got the goalkeeper system or the phalanx systems whizzing about, and I'm thinking, like, how on earth can you fly over an airfield if they've got anything of that equivalence? But what they were doing is turning off the radars so they wouldn't get hit by...
Yeah.
They were effectively blind firing it at you.
They were just hosing away, and because, you know, it's nighttime, we are completely lights out. They cannot see us at all. So we've got that on our side. We were coming in from all sorts of different, well, I say all sorts of different angles. There was this perception that the JP-233, we'd have to run down the runway to do that. Well, we weren't doing that. We did it a different way. We came across at different angles to keep us there far less predictable in terms of, you know, where they put their guns. So the idea was that we could cross cut taxiways and things like that, and also cut runways as well. So that was the idea. So we had two broad attack directions basically but yes, and as interesting enough, they did have some defenses, because a few nights later, Dave Waddington, Dave Waddington, Robbie Stewart, were shot down at Tilil by a Roland missile. So clearly they sort of, you know, a few days later, they decided, right, this time we're not going to do that. You know, we'll try and take a shot, and they were successful. But that night, they didn't turn the thing off, which is one good thing in our favour.
Wow.
So, you know, we've already discussed, and you've told us about the terrain following radar, and the fact that the lowest it goes is 200 feet. And we've already said that you operationally low fly at 100 feet. But... Yep. So I've got a couple of questions about the terrain following radar, because as I understand it, it had a number of different modes. So you had different rides, and so you had hard ride and you know, I can't remember what the other nomenclature was. But with that, is that what you were going in on? Was it a pretty rough ride, even though you're hands off at the time? Was the jet, you know, pitching quite significantly to remain at that 200 feet?
Not particularly. You're right. It was hard, medium, and soft ride. But between them, from what I recall, there wasn't a vast amount of difference. I mean, you know, flying in a hard ride was, well, I might say, probably a bit like flying with a QI.
Have you flown with Dunk?
No, it was the system couldn't cope. You know, so it was still a fairly smooth reacting whatever. So it was. We were flying in hard ride, but. Actually, when it comes to weapon release, then we had to disconnect the autopilot, because there were such big center of gravity changes then with all the bomblets coming off, that they had to disconnect the autopilot, and then just hold it straight level over the airfield.
Well, this was my next question, because the JP-233 had to be released at a very specific height, didn't it?
Well, the optimum height was 180 feet. The minimum height, I seem to recall, is 165 feet. Nick Hurd, who's scared out of his wits, disconnect the autopilot at 200 feet and doing a very gentle climb, if anything, was perfectly good for me. And that's exactly what I did. So, we were at 200 feet or so. I disconnect the autopilot with a few seconds to go, because you had head-up display symbology. Just as we approach, you know, we could you would commit the attack as you'd be, you know, so you put your finger on the button. And we both, front and back, made sure we both had our fingers on the commit buttons as hard as we possibly could to make sure we didn't, you know, forget to drop the bombs, which, of course, is a bit embarrassing after having come all that way. and then the bombs will start releasing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
And then it was, like I say, it was relatively easy. Again, stable aeroplane, it would hold it quite nicely. And I just sort of held it. We had a flight, you know, we had a head-up display with a flight path vector, so we knew exactly how to keep it absolutely spot-on level. And my view at all these trips, of course, was, you know, do not fly into the ground. Very simple. You know, ground, PK of one, probability of kill of one. If you fly into the ground, you're dead. So my view was very much of nothing as dangerous as just flying into the ground. So 200 feet is fine, and I just probably had a half a degree climb going as these bombs were coming off, and that was going to be, as far as I was concerned, perfectly good. And then, apart from
the tracer, were there any lights on the airfield? Did you have any visual cues at all, apart from your head-up display on an artificial horizon?
No, absolutely nothing. No, there were no lights on the airfield. It was just the only light was the AAA.
Yeah.
So I'm fairly confident it was an airfield there. Just, they got that much AAA, and we knew it was spot on target. Although interesting enough, one mission I think on that first night from one of the Tobruk missions actually came. Their first airfield they went to had no idea what was happening, and it was lit up, and the runway lights were on, and there was an aircraft in the circuit. I think something like that, and they actually attacked it.
Bloody hell.
Absolutely bizarre, you know. So I think that was one of the Tobruk missions had that.
Almost doesn't feel sporting, does it?
Not the case in Tallil. And that was it. And then, you know,
you imagine the guy in the circuit, downwind touch and go.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
What,
yeah.
And so, you know, all the big thumps as the canisters eventually come off.
Yeah.
And then does it all stop? You know, you're out of the Star Wars Canyon and the shooting stopped.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I mean, I was very quick to. I then put the autopilot back in again. I trusted the autopilot more than myself, so I put the autopilot back in again pretty sharply. The jet is 4.5 tons lighter, so really, you know, wow. Now we finally get going because, you know, we were attacking about 480 knots or so. We would have liked to have gone faster, but it just wouldn't go any faster. And of course, you imagine at night time, what we couldn't really do is use a reheat because, of course, that would light you up like a beacon. So we had to accept that 480 is about as fast as we could go. But as soon as the bombs are off, that's it. We're, you know, it's far better. And we sort of egressed at 510, 540 knots, something like that. And that was it. And then straight back into the sort of pitch black again.
So,
which is sort of quite bizarre.
On the attack, and I'm not even sure you can answer this, but nevertheless, this airfield has already been brutalised by B-52s. And you're the last guys in. So was the height at which you were flying in at, do you think that was beneficial to avoiding the AAA? Do you think they were arranged for something else?
Good question. I think you're right. I think they were because, you know, and I learned this a couple of nights later when I saw some very different. I felt as though I saw some very different AAA. But this, you know, I realised was essentially aiming sort of straight up. It was sort of straight up or a bit of an angle, something like that. But it wasn't orientated towards low flying aircraft. I didn't sort of feel any better because of that, because it still looked pretty dangerous. But I think it was sort of just hosing straight up and hoping they'll hit something. And so they weren't expecting probably any low flying traffic at all. But like I said, it made a difference to me. It's still bloody terrifying, but and that's it. Popped out the other side.
So you're back out the other side.
Yep.
Do you remember enormously elevated heart rate? Do you remember excitement? You know, that sort of rush of adrenaline once something like that has happened?
I think one of the interesting, you know, then sort of quite soon after, and then you start thinking, has everyone got through? And I was on the front pair, and there were sort of six other jets to come through behind me, which is going to take only a couple of minutes because they're all fairly closely packed in. So So then I think the thought was, you know, and then the, let's be careful here. Let's not fly into the ground now. Make sure we're all sorted out and heading away. Okay, that's all okay. And it's probably a little early. You know, we've definitely feel very pumped up at this point, you know, and God knows what the heart rate was up to. But and then probably the next thing was, and we did have a then sort of, as we wanted, a sort of a radio check-in. But the first time we'd all used the radio was just a check-in. And you know, all eight checked in, which, of course, is
brilliant.
And that was superb, actually. And then, of course, when we got that, we thought, oh, bloody hell, we've all got through that. Look at that.
Well, it's funny, you talking about it, Nick. I want to cheer at the point where number eight, yeah, exactly, you know, yeah, checks, yeah, in. Yeah. You know, you'd imagine when they're doing the movie, there's a slight pause, eight, yes, and everyone in each cockpit has got their, yeah, fists, yeah, up.
I'm sure we did. Where we hit it, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yeah. Oh,
you know, get in.
Deleted, you know, but yeah, it's, and that was it. And then, you know, and then the egress was, you know, just like it was going in. It was just all dark and nothing to really talk about. And that's it. Got back to the border, climbed up, met the tankers.
How was the tanking?
Well, tanking was absolutely, you know, I got so used to tanking, but, you know, and I was just, in fact, it was getting daylight by then. So, and it was the first daylight tank. I was in with that first daylight tank I'd done for ages. Because
So it was easy. Night.
It was easy. I was like, oh, I forgot how easy this was in daytime.
I think there's when you're often doing ops like that, there's also quite a camaraderie. I bet the tankers were really pleased to see you as well. Did you get any, yeah, reception or any idea of them being pleased to see you guys?
It's difficult, really, because it was all kind of non-radio, you know, as you do.
Yeah.
It didn't need the radio, so they were there. It was, you know. It's great to see them there, of course.
Sign from the Lodi out the window.
Well, yeah. Or it's a Victor. You can't see anyone in a Victor. We couldn't really express our thanks. So just all quietly, professionally got on with it and, you know, pressed, yeah, on home, you know. But and that was that. And then, of course, we came back, the sun comes up and then it gets light and we go back to Bahrain. And, you know. And in fact, the strange thing was there. I finished up, although I was at the front for this front pair. My V-back then had an oil pressure caption on one engine, so I stayed with him. We sort of came. He didn't have to divert anywhere. He was going to bring it home, but it meant we came home sort of slowly than the other six. So the other six landed ahead of us, and they had the TV crews all over them. And we weren't expecting this either. Air Force was there. Was hopeless as a sort of PR in those days. And we landed, there were TV crews all over the place. And then that, the video dunk that, you know, I showed you, the TVAM video, where a lot of the people who have interviewed were, you know, all the, that was that mission on that we'd just come back from. But because we landed about 10 minutes, 15 minutes behind everyone else, they'd all gone home by then, really. Sort of, so, yeah, sort
that's
of
probably
shot
a good
that.
Thing.
I didn't get any picture, though. I just got distorted with it. Anyway. So, and then the surreal bit comes back because then we land and sort of debrief and do the 700 and all this sort of stuff and go back to the hotel.
Was there a sense of elation? What was where you were all, you know, signing in the jets and that sort
of
stuff?
Did you go for beer?
Well, we went to debrief. You know, the debrief was, you know, just big and noisy and just, you know, I think we were just so pleased that first mission had gone so well. As Rupert Clark put it as Rupert would be, it ran on rails. It really did run on rails. It was a brilliant trip, you know. Bit in the middle was, but everything else went as it should have done. It was a really good start, and we were just dead chuffed that we'd got everyone back in particular, and we'd all done it. We'd all bombed on track, you know, on time and everything. It was really good, you know. We thought, oh, piece of old ease.
And did you get a BDA, a battle damage assessment? Did you get any of that? Did you see, were they successful attacks?
Yeah, it took a few days before we started getting BDA reports, you know, and we started getting some pictures. In fact, I mean, later on in the war, because we then moved to the daytime phase, we could start, my backseater took his camera with him and, well, you know, I've got a bunch of shots, I'll bring him in sometime. For example, Tahlil, we fly past Tahlil all the time in the end, and we could take our own pictures and we could see our own. I could see my own sort of so-called line in the sand that my JPs had done, you know, and which is just kind of good to see.
I thought you meant battle damage assessment on your own jets then.
Oh, I see. No, no. Oh, well. No.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Did you have, were there any holes in any of the aeroplanes?
I think so. I mean, I don't recall anybody getting hit in well, not to the point of being able to bring a jet back. Clearly, people got hit and didn't come home, sort of thing. You know, there might have been one jet from Tobruk, I think, might have got hit by something. But basically, I think we all learned the lesson really, really quickly, as you learn lessons quickly in war, I think, that the AAA, the anti-aircraft fire, looks bad, but there's clearly a lot of daylight in between. You know, because if that, you know, if eight of us have just got through there, then as long as you don't fly into the ground, you know, don't get too distracted by it, you should be okay. So it's one, you know, I think we all learned that on that first night.
Sort of big sky theory.
Absolutely. And it's much as it looked a bit compressed, it's actually probably not as compressed as at all. And it just, you know, so just be careful.
I saw some pictures on the, you know, the coverage on Twitter that's been going on of some tornadoes with great big holes in. It looks like they were in flaps or slats or, you know, some.
Well, okay.
I think some did take some rounds.
Okay, yeah. Well, it could well be. And I don't think it happened in Bahrain, but it might have happened elsewhere. I think our view was generally, if you get hit by something, you know, that's probably going to be pretty catastrophic. I mean, I suppose some of these shells could go through without, if they haven't fused or something, you know, perhaps they might just go through without exploding, which, who knows? If it's that low, it's obviously, there's a certain, presumably a certain fusing time or arming time with the shell. I don't know, but. Anyway, but as far as I'm concerned, I didn't get hit by anything, I'm glad to say.
And how did, because you've already mentioned you then went from, so how many night JP233 missions did you do?
Well, so I did three of them. Because we spent the first 4 or 5 days doing this, because it was the classic counter-air thing, you know, is attack their air force so that they can't fly. And that's, you know, that's the whole role of us on the Tornado and JP233. So I went back the following night.
And just on that, Nick... Yeah. Knowing what lay ahead of you now, was it worse or was it easier?
Well, it's funny. I kind of, you know, because I went, you know, as we go back to, went back to the hotel, you know, as I said. And, I mean, that was a bit bizarre, that first morning, you know. So you go back to the hotel, buffet breakfast is on. So there's no hotel guests other than military. So it's not as though it's not Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so from Skegness visiting, right? You know, it's our hotel. So. But strangely enough, so we've got to go to bed now, but well, I'll go have some breakfast. So I'm going to have some breakfast. And would you believe, I think supply officer came down, and for some reason, he'd missed everything. He hadn't turned the TV on. He came down and sat with me. Oh, morning, mate. Yeah, how are you? You know, anything going on? it started, mate. Are you going to get the news on? Has it? Yes. We're just back from our first mission. Oh, Christ. Okay. All right. Bizarre. So, but then, I mean, I sort of went up to the room, and I mean, we were taking temazepam, you know, sleeping tablets, which I found bloody marvellous. I really slept well with temazepam, and I took some of the previous few nights, and I took a couple more that night or that morning, and fell straight asleep. I was kind of just fine, which was just bizarre, really. I thought I might struggle, but I struggle now these days, I think. But those, I don't know. I just went back to sleep.
Did you have a breakfast beer?
I don't think I did, actually. I think I went. I didn't do a beer.
Wash the temazepam down with a breakfast beer.
Dunk has a breakfast beer every day, don't you? You swear by it.
Yeah.
If I might sort of just finish up, I mean, that first night, just from a sort of funny story then, of my wife getting, at the time I'd only been married about a year and a half or so. We didn't have any kids. So my wife was working. She was working as a civilian nurse in the Lara Medical Center at the time. Now, of course, it was January time, and normally in Germany there was the RAF Germany ski championships that went on down in Val d'Isère. Now, this year, or that year, there were not many blokes around because kind of most people were down in the Gulf. So they decided, well, we'll carry on doing this, but we'll drag some of the wives in. So my wife finishes up going down to Val d'Isère for the ski championship, which starts a few days before the Gulf War starts. Anyway, so I can't really be in touch with her very well, and it's clearly a different. There's no internet anywhere or anything like that, clearly. So come the morning I've gone back to bed and I've gone back to sleep. She's down in Val d'Isère and she's up with the first, you know, waiting for the first ski lift. She hasn't heard anything, what's been going on. And, but she's standing in the queue for the ski lift. And she hears people sort of talking, in fact, French people talking a little bit animatedly about la guerre dans la Gulf. And she said, oh, okay. So she wanders down, finds a phone box, put some money in and calls me directly in the hotel in Bahrain. So So here we are. We've just gone back to sleep, and the phone rings, which you don't really want. Backseat, Rob picks it up, and oh, Nick, it's Jane. So I hand over the phone. She says, "Hi, what's going on?" So there we are. I sort of explained to her, "Well, yeah, it's kind of started, and we've just done our first trip, and yeah, it went very well, and can't say much else really." But
do you not think what you? The supplier? No one knows what's going on.
Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah, so anyway, so that's quite amusing, that sort of phone call. And, oh, how's skiing then? Is the snow all right? You know, oh, yeah, good, jolly. Well, best to go back to bed now. You know, best to go in and put the phone down. We're about to sleep. But, you know, strange. Funny business. What? But
the ski championships in Val d'Isère is possibly the most Paul Godfrey event that I've ever heard.
Yeah, I'll have you know, JB, I've only ever been on one ski championships in my life, and that was in 1992.
Why, were you in Bermuda or something?
I haven't been on one since.
Wow.
Did you nearly drink yourself to death? Is that why?
Yes.
Oh, we're all laughing.
It was really just Nick just talking about what... Got to say, was it more scary the second time?
Well,
knowing what was out there?
It's interesting. I sort of came away with, like I say, with a certain amount of confidence, shall we say, you know, thinking, okay, I can do this. I'm a warrior now. I can do it. And that was all very well until I went back to work on the second evening, when by then we'd lost two jets. The two Johns had been shot down. They're of my squadron. We didn't know what had happened to them. We didn't know. And then, in fact, well, okay, we'd only lost one jet by the time I went to work that evening. It was about 6 or 7 p.m., whilst we were then setting up for that trip that night, I wandered out because there was another mission just returning at about probably at 6 or 7 p.m. They were just coming back, and I wandered out to meet the jet, just say hi, how did it go? And that's when they'd lost the jet as well. That's when OC Bill Boss of 27 Squadron, Nigel Elston and Max Collier had crashed just off target. And, you know, I mean, knew they were dead, you know. So, and all of a sudden, you know, having for 24 hours previous or early that morning, I thought, this is okay. And all of a sudden, we lost two jets. And you think, yes, this is, I forget, you know, this, or don't forget, this is serious. So then I got quite worried again then, thought, oh, bloody hell. Perhaps we were just very lucky on that first night, and now we're going to get hacked to pieces tonight.
Yeah. And what had happened with OC-27? Had he done what you desperately tried not to?
Had he
just flown into the ground, or were they shot down?
No, the feeling was from the guys who talked about it was that they did their trip. I can't remember they basically went straight up the Gulf as we had sort of said, and then they crossed into Iraq that way. And they overland. They said they were being shot at all the way for whatever. I can't remember where they were attacking. They dropped their weapons, and it was only off target. And apparently, it was actually a fairly quiet bit all of a sudden. And then they saw this crash, which was clearly an aircraft just crashing into the ground. You know, that sort of long sort of flame. And the feeling was that he probably had just flown into the ground. Didn't seem to be any defences there right now. I mean, I don't know if there was any proof in that. Actually, let's not. I won't go into perhaps there might be sensitivities here, which I perhaps won't go into on this forum as to the position why that OC-27 might and why that might have happened to him. Yeah, sadly, you know, we think that's probably what was the case. So all of a sudden we lost two jets, and it's pretty damn serious.
So you'd gone in at 7. So just and I'm ignorant to this, so apologies for that. But
yeah,
and the two Johns had gone in. Were there day missions going at the same time? So were those boys going in the day, and you were in the night? So it wasn't just Tornadoes doing night JP-233. The squadrons were also doing day missions as well.
Yes, well, the only mission that went really was the two Johns mission. That was the only one that went. Now, interesting, they came to work, I remember, on that first night when we were just walking to the jets for the first mission, and they turned up then to sort of do their planning. So they would be on the ground for a few hours, but they were flying, they were taking off about 6 in the morning for a entirely daytime trip, and they were doing lofting a loft attached with 1,000-pounders. We knew that JP-233U was just, we couldn't do that in daytime. We'd just be sitting ducks, you know, that'd be no good at all.
Yeah.
So they were doing lofting of 1,000-pounders. And then that mission, and then I think it was a bit of a, and that was it. But then I think then the next missions were these early evening missions then of the second night. And this 27 squadron mission came out with, you know, with one guy down. So like I said, my four ship or eight ship, we were on this sort of routine of taking off about 2 in the morning and getting back at 6 in the morning, which I was quite happy with, really.
Yeah, I think probably most people, just because of the, as you've said, at night no one can see you, you do feel a little less vulnerable, don't you?
Absolutely, yes, yes. I mean, see, of course, we had Jaguars at Bahrain as well. We didn't forget the Jaguars, and they did a damn good job throughout. And they seem to have the tactics right for daytime, because they started up at high level of Jaguar anyway, 15,000 or so, or, and they would sort of go around those sort of heights and then sort of dive down to attack and then pull up again. Mm. And for some reason, the Tornado, we didn't seem to really consider that until a bit later in the war.
So when was that switch then? So, you know, having run through a bunch of these missions, how far into it was the, hang on, we're losing too many aircraft here, we need to switch to medium level?
Well, it was essentially at the end of the first week, let's say, 5-6 days into it, something like that. You know, because we did lose, we kind of lost 4 jets that first week. And if you the Iraqi Air Force were not flying, you know, there was a bit of flying went up, but they quickly stopped flying. And so therefore we didn't need to keep, you know, doing these hairy missions against their airfields because they just weren't going to fly. So they
buggered off to Iran, didn't they?
Well, there was a lot of that went on, yes. A lot of them scuttled off over there. And the rest just presumably just tucked away in their houses and just sort of in their hardened aircraft shelters and left them to it there, basically.
Yeah, and they buried some, I think.
That turned out after the war. I think they found some buried ones or something like that. Yeah, yes. They might put them in the hardened aircraft shelters, but most of those got trashed later in the war anyway, with laser-guided bombs, of course, which became our sort of job later in the during the war.
Can I just ask about the change of priorities from low level to medium? Was that because of losses of jets, or was that because, well, basically job done?
Well, it's kind of both, really, I would say. I would imagine the losses were significant, you know, because, you know, that's a pretty hefty loss rate, really. We were sort of kind of losing, you know, it was almost one a night, and we all knew each other as well. There's that aspect, you know, none of us didn't know each other. So it was, I mean, all right, and some guys survived and all this, which was, although that we didn't find out until perhaps a little bit later in proceedings. But no, it's probably more tactically. We didn't need to do it again. So it was happy enough to sort of shift things up to this, climate bombing, you know, just doing our stuff from 20,000 feet, different weapons and things like that. I mean, having said, moved up to 20,000, I was actually being a little bit scared again then, because I thought, well, hang on, I've spent all these years of flying around low level, thinking that's where the place to be, and now they shoved me up at 20,000 feet. I mean, now I'm in the heart of envelopes of all sorts of missiles around, and say threes and sixes and things like that. And here I am, sort of floating around in the sky. So I actually felt a little bit uncomfortable at medium level to start with.
When did you start teaming up with Buccaneers then? Was that one of your roles?
Yeah. So that happened. So we did a couple of weeks of this sort of night attacks then, and that became a bit of a sort of, we went back to Tilil and one or two airfields where we could drop 8,000 pounders onto the airfield. Not aiming terribly specifically on the airfield, but just somewhere on the airfield, just to sort of wreck their day, you know, it just makes a mess. So we did that for a couple of weeks or so, something like that. And that was everything settled down. Although, interesting, one of the losses we had, actually not from us, but from Daran, they lost a jet. This was Bob Ankerson was the navigator, and the pilot was Simon Burgess, Buddy Burgess. And they brought themselves down with some big cock-up with the new multifunction bomb fuse that was being used, and due to some arming cock-up, they released their bombs, their 1,000-pound bombs from, you know, 20,000 feet, and the bombs have been incorrectly armed. Arming a bomb is when it's there's a certain time frame when it leaves the aircraft before it arms and they're ready to go bang. Now, if you're dropping a bomb from 20,000 feet, the arming time could be a long time because it's not going to hit the ground for 30 seconds. For some reason, there was a bit of a cock-up, and they set the arming time to 1 second. So, unfortunately, these bombs were released, and 1 second later, they were armed, and didn't take much for one of them to go off. And one of them did, and then several went off, and it kind of brought the aircraft down. So, in fact, we nearly lost 2 jets that night, in fact, because one aircraft, yeah, they got brought down and ejected and got captured, and another aircraft got pretty badly damaged. And came home. So a bit of a cocker. Essentially things settled down a bit then, really. We stopped taking the losses then, and it was, you know, it was fine. So we did that for a couple of weeks, and then it became clear that precision guidance of weapons was required. And that's when the Buccaneers got brought in at very short notice. I've been told for weeks and months that they were not going to be involved. And again, in a classic military way, I think they were sort of told, oh, my God, you know, go to the Middle East. You should have been there yesterday, sort of thing. And they hurried down to the Middle East, did a very, very good job of a very short bit of in theatre training. And that's it. Then we shifted for the second half of the war to the sort of daytime bit of sort of because actually we couldn't do our own guiding of bombs from the Tornado.
Yeah.
Were they using the tiled pod or was it the pave tack or whatever it was?
Yes, they were using it. That was pave tack, wasn't it? That's what they. The tiled pod was starting to come into service actually on the Tornado. So we started getting a few missions using tiled pods. But essentially, all my trips were done with the Buccaneer doing the spiking, which is a bizarre sort of situation. This Buccaneer, 35-year-old jet, comes in to support the new bomber, sort of thing, because it can't manage it on its own. But they did. I took my hat off the Buccaneer boys. They did a really good job of turning up and going straight into theatre and doing their stuff.
It's funny, as soon as you say Buccaneer, I just have this mental picture of that. Because they weren't as pink as the desert colour you were flying. I'm not sure.
I guess not.
But the one with the sort of Jolly Roger on the side, I think is probably one of the iconic photos from back then. Were they based with you in Bahrain, the ones?
Yes, I think, I'm not sure. Yes, I think they're exclusive with us in Bahrain, so which is fine for us. We could liaise with them very easily then, but I think they were also doing trips with the guys from Dharan, which mean they were, you mentioned the communications difficulties of, bearing in mind, there's all these fancy calls that go on and bananas and this, that, and the other, and they have to, because the laser guiding stuff, the timing had to be just right, because they couldn't, when you drop a laser guided bomb, they couldn't turn on the laser straight away. There had to be a certain timing to allow the bomb to sort of fall its proper trajectory, and then they would start lasing. So there's a certain amount of calls, and so they knew when the bomb is in the air and wait for it, then start lasing, and so pretty complex stuff. But again, the first mission I did with LGBs was to head for a bridge in the middle of, on the, somewhere in the Tigris. And I'd never dropped an LGB in my life. It was no big deal for us at the Tornado. All we had to do was drop the bombs in the basket, as it's known as, in the sort of basket where the laser would work, which a Tornado did very well. That's all we had, so I just turned up, when you 3-2-1, boop, boop, boof, three laser guided bombs go. And then we just carry on flying, and 30 odd seconds later, drop a wing. And sure enough, there's a big explosion on this bridge. And as we all sort of see picture of that sort of thing. And I was gobsmacked, never seen that before. Bloody hell, look at that. It's incredible.
It's something I meant to mention earlier, but, clearly you mentioned prior to internet, but prior to GPS as well, there was no global navigation system here. So everything that you guys were doing was kit updates and what's termed the Kalman filter on the navigation. Kit, you talked about the radar offset with the fence in order to update the kit, because the kit will drift in terms of the inertial navigation system. And even this, you're navigating at this point, aren't you, to try and find, the navigator in the Buccaneer is the one that's searching to try and find the bridge. You're getting to a release point that, again, isn't updated by anything else other than kit that your navigators are updating.
Absolutely right. Yes, I mean, and at least at the Tornado, it wasn't bad nav kit at all. Actually, it did a pretty decent job. But the Buccaneer guys, I don't think they had anything. And I was gobsmacked. And of course, the navigator at the back of the Buccaneer, his screen, it was a classic sort of. It's down by his right elbow or something, and it's the lever works the wrong direction or something. It's completely non-intuitive, And for them to acquire the target, I was gobsmacked at how they managed it. I mean, we had to go from we definitely sort of talked about the first missions were so-called, O-level standard, we said, and then we moved up to A-level, then we moved to sort of degree level, depending on the sort of, and by the end of it, a week or two later, we were doing, we were going to airfields, and we were doing things like working away around HAZ sites, and specifically in a certain sequence, they go for that HAZ and that HAZ, and which is obviously more complex than just a single a single bridge. I thought the Buccaneers were pretty damned awesome. It was always slightly embarrassing when we came back, when we always came off target. Tornado was typically sort of going about 20 or 1,000 feet with bombs on. But when we got the bombs off, we'd go about 25 or so and go back to the tanker and then come home again. Well, the Buccaneers would come with us, and the bombs, when we dropped our bombs, the Buccaneer would go straight to 40,000 feet and go straight home. Just brilliant, just awesome. They'd be home half an hour before us, just because Just they could. They had the power and the internal bomber. You know, wow, get it, brilliant, so, very impressive.
I've got two questions for you on that.
So, say again, sorry.
I've got two questions for you on that. Okay, so first question would be. Very simple. Like, I take it your four ships became six ships, did they, or was it five aircraft?
Effectively, yes. We effectively were sort of two Tornadoes with a Buccaneer.
All right. Yeah. Okay. And yeah. The second one is, why didn't you just get the Buccaneers to drop the bombs?
They started doing that as well. They did, in fact. And there's a very good bit of film out there, which I saw on YouTube the other day. Reminded me, I think I was on the same mission actually, where this Buccaneer, who if they when we'd finished, we dropped our bomb, we go home. If the Buccaneer had a couple of bombs, they could look around and add a bit to it. And there's this, I think it's a Russian twin, a Cub, I think, is it? Well, anyway, this Russian sitting on an airfield somewhere, and they spot it, and they bomb it, and they blow the damn thing to pieces. It's out there on YouTube, and the commentary on that is bloody marvellous. They really are pleased with themselves.
So why were
all the Bucks based up at Lossiemouth at that point?
They were, yeah.
Or was it 208 and 12 Squadron?
Yeah. And I guess those are the two, weren't they?
And what were they up to before that? Were they anti-shipping? Or
yes.
Yeah, that was the main sort of role, yeah. Yeah.
But they had this laser. Of a rhubarb, isn't it? They'd go out and find targets of opportunity.
Yeah. But they were bloody good, actually. Very impressive. And of course, a year or two later, it went out of service, and that was that. But it was a very good finish for the Buccaneer, I think.
And were you? And so, at this point, when are we talking? Are we into February? You know, the sort of mid to end of February then? Because when did the air war go on to March? Well, wasn't it?
The war finished on the 28th of February.
28th. Okay.
So, I mean, we talk about this daytime bit. I got scared again. Then you see, after being two weeks at night. Then I got daytime, and I think, bloody hell. Now, not only am I at medium level, which I don't like, I'm in daytime as well. Now they can see me again.
Did anything lock you up in terms of RWRs?
Yeah. Not particularly. And in fact, probably by this stage, you know, I say I was a bit scared, but probably by this stage, we were getting perhaps a little complacent. And it came back to bite us on the 14th of February, I know the date because it was Valentine's Day, and we were tasked to go against Habaniya Airfield, which is a bit west of Baghdad by about 30 odd miles. And we were going to be working. This was going to be working our way around the HAZ site, bombs on each through each HAZ, something like that. So eight Tornadoes, four Buccaneers, and attacking at sort of dawn, early mornings. So that was quite a long way up. That was a long way up into Iraq, you know. So, okay, all right. So off we went. All went fine to start with it. And we started attacking. Now, in that case, our four ship was the rear four ship. So I was going to be number six for that trip of going through target. Anyway, we started going through and, you know, bombs started dropping. We went through number six. Our bombs went. We seemed to splash pretty well on the targets. And then we sort of peeled off to the north and to sort of, you know, for the route home. But a couple of minutes later, then we sort of thinking, okay, so number seven should be going through about now. And then number eight was going through. Number eight was Rupert Clark and Steve Hicks. You may know Rupert. Anyway, at some point, this is the final Buccaneer who is looking at the target, sees two missile launches and calls it on the radio. You know, he goes, missile launch, missile launch, because he sees them physically come off the rails. We're not too far away. We're not sure what the missiles are, but clearly we start looking and manoeuvring and trying to see what's going on. We have nothing on the radar warning receiver at this point. But clearly we're looking to see what's out there, because we're not too far away. Anyway, I can't quite remember the sequence of events eventually, there's a sort of call on the radio that someone says, you know, looks like someone's been hit. And we do then start to see the smoke trail of a jet clearly over the target area. And yes, it started to go down. Now, it didn't go down very... It's interesting. It goes down at quite a relatively shallow angle, about a 10-degree dive, something like that. It doesn't sort of just fall out of the sky. So, and we start watching it, basically, then, to see what, you know... Well, we don't know if it's a tornado or a Buccaneer at this point. But again, a quick radio check reveals that it's number eight, Rupert and Steve Hicks. So and that's it. And then we kind of then just sat. We were some distance. We were able to sort of watch it all the way then as it went down. We were keeping our eyes out in case any other missiles are out there. But There was nothing else, no other warnings. But and we watched this smoke trail. Now, this is quite some distance, probably about 8-10 miles away. So, but of course, we were watching it, hoping to see a couple of seats come out. But as it was, we didn't see anything, and we watched it all the way down to impact. You know, we saw the explosions hit the ground, and we thought, ah, you know, I think they've had it. Anyway, and we pressed on home, and that was that. You know, we went home and fairly quietly, shall we say, and got back. And that was it. So what we think was a pair of SA3s got launched out there, and we think the guy who launched them knew what he was doing because he fired them sort of optically to start with, so no radar on at all, and then probably just put on his guidance probably just the last few seconds. So he was, you know, there's no way any harm shooter was going to get him, and he just sort of, you know, and it just got Rupert and Hixie. Now, have you heard Rupert's story? Anyone sort of?
I have a while ago, actually. But okay. So remind me, you know, from his perspective, what happened in the aeroplane?
Well, they'd just been in a position of dropping their bombs, and they had one bomb had hung up, which is a little unfortunate. You know, these things, you know. So they were actually trying hard to get rid of this sort of final bomb, and I think they didn't really do anything in the way about the missile. And in fact, really, they didn't manoeuvre at all, and both these missiles just kind of went off outside the aeroplane. And you'll know, you know, an SA-3 is a big missile with a big warhead, and it killed Steve Hicks immediately. He was instantly killed by the missile. Rupert, I think, is an astonishingly lucky guy, because there's, you know, all sorts of high-velocity ball bearings flying around, and he survived, didn't seem to get touched. But the aircraft was clearly sort of, you know, completely wrecked, and he had no control of it. And it just, you know, came down. And I think he eventually ejected about 5,000 feet or so, something like that. And, of course, it's command eject, so he pulled the handle, so the backseater went anyway. So they did eject, and we just clearly couldn't see it from where we were, which, yeah, doesn't surprise me. And that's that. And I think he tells the story, as he says, you know, because, you know, he comes down and gets captured pretty quickly. But he gets, I think, about half an hour later, from after bombing this airfield, he was back in the base commander's office of this airfield at Havana, having a cup of tea with him. And this base commander was, you know, speaking to him in very good English about and telling him all the training he'd done with the RAF, you know, his few years ago when he'd been over in UK. You know, it's a very, very bizarre sort of situation for a little
tea
while.
And biscuits didn't last for poor old Rupert,
no,
though,
and then that's right. Then the heavy guys turned up and took him off to the Baghdad Hilton, and he had a few weeks there.
By this time in the war, I can't remember when it happened, but you know, when did the Johns appear on TV? So, you know, all of these people where you'd seen Watto, you know, yeah, that hadn't come back, you didn't know whether they were alive or not. When did they appear, and when did you get the inkling that there might be some survivors out there?
Well, it's about 3 or 4 days, I suppose, after they'd been shot down, they appeared. That's when they appeared on TV.
Okay, so it was quite quickly.
It was quite quick. So at least we knew. I mean, a lot of the guys, oh, look, fantastic, they're alive. And I looked at them and thought, they don't look very good shape. I have to say, I'm not quite sure what's going on with it. But yes, entirely right. At least we were happy that we could see they were alive. But there's no word of anybody else. We didn't know of any, you know, there was no, that's it. We didn't know about anybody else, alive, dead, no idea. So the only time that we sort of realised who was alive and who was dead ultimately came, and we'll leave it ahead of it now, after the war ended. You know, we then sort of sat for over a few days and wondered what was going to happen. And then it became clear that POWs were going to get released. And then we came up with this plan of a sort of buddy-buddy system for whoever was missing was going to have somebody to go meet them at Riyadh, because they were going to get a flight, a Red Cross flight from Baghdad to Riyadh, where they'd get released. So the idea was that we wanted them to have a sort of a friendly face that they could see. What we knew was going to be a real sort of media melee, and it's exactly what happened. So I got sprung from Bahrain to go meet up with Rupert, because I did. In fact, Rupert and myself and Charlie Brown had all joined the same IOT. So we all knew. Yeah. Anyway, so that's it. We flew over to Riyadh, all of us, you know, all the buddies, and this Red Cross flight turns up, and we're all standing in the crowd, and our job is just to watch out for whoever steps out and go and grab them. So there was somebody there for Dave Waddington, Robbie Stewart, and Rupert Larkin, Steve Hicks, and all this sort of stuff. So Rupert, you know, when I see Rupert come out of this aeroplane, I fight my way through the scrum and sort of you know, go grab Rupert, you know, oh, Nick. And I grab him and sort of walk this way. And that's it. And we basically, the deal was we take them and shuttle them over to this RFVC-10, which is waiting and ready to go. And when everyone was off the Baghdad, you know, this flight, we closed the doors and we shot off to Cyprus and went to Akrotiri.
And how was he? What was his reaction to see you?
Well, I'm probably a bit bewildered, I think. You know, they're all, none of them are sort of terribly good shape. They're all pretty malnourished and being a bit beaten up and all this other stuff. So he didn't sort of express, I can't remember this look at his face, but, you know, I'm sure he's pretty pleased, I think, but perhaps a bit bewildered. Anyway, the main thing was we all got on this VC-10, and it wasn't just us, it was the SAS guys as well, who'd been, you know, they'd been, some of them had been captured. They had the same deal going on. And that's it. And sadly, that's where we realised that, you know, the people, who weren't coming back. We knew that Steve Hicks wasn't in there, Kev Weeks and Gary Lennox were the other guys who, you know, weren't on there. So their buddies didn't meet anybody. They went back to where they went. But we, like I say, we then shot off to Akrotiri, where obviously there's a hospital there and they could get the POW sort of some medical treatment. And we just, actually, to be honest, it was a really lovely, as the nicest. I mean, I didn't go to Akrotiri that many times in my Air Force career, but that was the nicest time because it was just now early March in Akrotiri, springtime, just survived the war, and it was very pleasant. We had a very pleasant few days of R&R, really, just getting back into back to normal.
So, but Parky, were you in Akrotiri at that point?
Yeah.
Is Parky still there?
I am. We've had a, by the way, you had a power cut here, so I'm sitting in the dark. Bizarre. I might just check my logbook and find out if I was still in Cyprus. I think we may well have been. I do, you know, I remember the boys all coming back through. Where were you, Nick? Were you just sort of, you know, literally in the mess? You know,
They put us in the hotel as well, actually, which I thought was I don't know why, but they did. They just left us in. It just kept us all together. So we were just staying at the hotel, which is fine. But we still came up to we did have at least one, after a couple of nights, we did sort of decide that, because we thought the POWs were getting a little bit too much of the medics and the psychiatrists and all this sort of stuff.
Can I buy that?
And they might need a bit of a proper rehabilitation. So we sprung them all, took them all up to the bar, and we got going on the brandy sours.
And nice.
It was brilliant. It was bloody good, actually. And in fact, one or two didn't last very long. They went, but one or two, John Nicol and people like that, they stuck it out all right.
Good man. Did you end up going back to Bahrain after that? Or no. Was that for you that Zavor was over?
That's it. Well, yes. And that's it. And then a few days later, we got another VC-10, which took all the Germany crews back, basically. So we all got this VC-10. We flew to Bruggen, dropped off the Bruggen crews, hopped over to Larbrook, and got back on a very pleasant Sunday afternoon back in Germany, and nice, everyone, all the families waiting for us, and and it was a lovely, very nice reception back at base. It was lovely, as Larbrook always was, but just a really nice sort of meeting up again. A bit sad, well, yeah, because three guys didn't come back from Larbrook.
Well, yeah, I know.
But the rest of us, it was lovely. It was just great to get back, you know, as you can imagine.
Yeah, definitely bittersweet, I guess. You know, for you, how was the, you know, how was meeting your wife again and, you know, and that sort of thing? Was it strange to be back? All of it, you know, no. I've just come back from 6 months away. I wasn't doing anything nearly as courageous as you. But, you know, it is always strange coming back after a long time away when you've been doing other stuff, you've been in the military environment. You know, that must have been a hell of a reunion and a reintegration into normal society.
Yeah, I think it was, I don't know, I didn't sort of recall any particular wake up screaming in the night or anything. You know, it's quite it's probably different, you know. I mean, something I always sort of thought about afterwards was the fact that at the time, I said I'd be married a year and a half, no kids, and that was the position we were in. Now, my backseater, a little bit older than me, 3 or 4 years older than me, had two sort of kids of 8 and 10, something like that. And it's only after I had my own kids, I thought to myself, what must it have been like to be flying this if you've got children at home?
I can imagine.
And in particular, as a navigator, you know, when you've got no control of your life whatsoever. you know, in the backseat of a strike tornado, there's no stick. You've got no. If the guy flies you into the ground, you know, I don't know. I mean, we all say, well, should have worked harder at flying training, shouldn't you, and all that sort of stuff, you know. But it was. So I don't know. Perhaps at the time I'd become sort of quite, I don't know, hardened or something like that. But I quickly shook that off as I got home again and thought, here we are back in Germany. And it was beautiful, beautiful springtime. And it was just nice to get back to my favourite bar, you know, and with everyone there. And let's go and drink as all stupid. And it was just great. I didn't have a problem with that.
Brilliant. It's funny you should mention that. You know, I had a conversation with a guy just the other day. And, you know, having been childless in the 90s, you know, doing the Bosnia thing and that sort of stuff. Oh, yeah. Not a care in the world. Bulletproof. Yeah. Iraq in 2001. No, 2000, coming up to 2003, 2002, 2003, and I had a 2-year-old at that point. Genuinely, completely different kettle of fish.
Yeah, interesting, yeah.
You know, yeah. I felt completely different at that particular point. Like I say, you know, one for the psychologist and one for a later date, but interesting you mentioned that as well.
Do you know what? Yeah. Interestingly, on the same topic, they say exactly the same thing about F1 drivers. F1 drivers with kids, they don't last particularly long. They don't win.
Interesting. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I certainly felt that way very much. Myself. You know, only subsequently realizing it that was the case. So I'm not saying I was being suicidal during the Gulf War or anything like that. But at the same time, I was thinking, well, you know, we were newly married, but if my wife is still very young, if I don't come back. I was quite well insured, actually. In fact, I started to get a little bit concerned about it. I was probably too well insured. I thought, if I'd be ringing up Saddam saying, hey, he's had a bit to live tonight. Get your boys out. So, anyway.
So, Nick, I've only got one last question for you, and then I'll open it up to the lads for any more. But the thing which kind of amazed me about the Tornado Force is that you didn't take more losses. I kind of think of what you were asked to do. It's probably been one of the more dangerous things, if not the most dangerous thing, which is attack very heavily guarded airspace, very, very, very low level. So after it's all been said and done, how did you rate the performance of the Tornado Force? Was it adequate? Or did you change the way that you did things? What did you learn?
Well, I think for the job we were asked to do, I thought we did it very well. We were stuck with this weapon. JP-23 requires an aeroplane to be put over the top of an airfield at 200 feet, and you know the Tornado does that perfect. They did it then. You drop the bombs within 10 feet where they need to be, and that's brilliant. It's just not a very good place to be. So I thought we did a really good job. As I say, nobody, as far as I'm aware, sort of pulled out or anything like that. Everybody really just gritted their teeth and did it. So there's a fantastic sort of force camaraderie there that was really good. The Iraqis, if they had, for example, I mentioned this fact about turning on their radars a bit more, then they could have hacked us out. If a bit more cleverer people knew what they were doing with their radars, probably just opening up for a few seconds, take a shot, shut down again, so they wouldn't be vulnerable to anti-radar missiles, then we would have lost more, because we were, you know, as the guys know, as something like ZSU-23, a big four-barreled Russian gun, been around for many years, was a very capable weapon against low-flying aircraft. And we were, you know, not that fast and not that low, shall we say. We weren't manoeuvring very hard, so we could have been quite vulnerable to them. So, you know, we could have lost more if they'd done that. Or indeed, you know, the guys who shot down Dave Waddington at Tilly a few nights after me, you know, who heard more Rolands, and they could have might have done more. But you know, then we changed our tactics now, you know, and in fairness, I'd say since that first week of the Gulf War, low flying has just never really been part of, you know, it's sort of obviously disappeared from the Air Force's priorities as each year passes, which probably rightly so. There is much less requirement to sort of low fly anymore. So instead of all this low fly we used to do and very little else, it's completely the other way, which probably makes us more capable, because dropping weapons from higher levels, be it dumb weapons or precision, whatever, is very different to dropping at low level. And so I think we did a decent job. I mean, tactically, I think by this first week of JP-23, we probably didn't have to do that, I suspect. We could have done something different, but nobody complained, because that's kind of what we did at the time. And we were sort of pretty comfortable with the idea and thought, well, okay, this is what we do, so we'll go do it.
But I guess you weren't to know it wasn't needed to be done. I think with hindsight, it's easy to say, yeah, we didn't need to do that because they didn't fly. But, you know, it did need to be done.
Yeah, yeah. But we probably could have done it. We might have been able to. The JP, you know, a few missions of Tornadoes compared to the massive American presence, you know, was, I'm not saying as a token, it wasn't a token gesture by any means, but, you know, if we'd just been dropping 1,000-pounders from 20,000 feet on those airfields, I think the war would have been won just as well.
Yes, I see.
So we didn't really need to do this low-level stuff. But like I say, we were all comfortable enough doing it. One or two losses were, I don't want to sort of hesitate to sort of start talking about the two Johns, but, you know, they were, you know, there were issues on their mission which caused them to be, you know, there was a like cock up in, you know, they didn't get their bombs off, and which is, you know, a little unfortunate sort of switchery issue. But, you know, it's your first war mission. It's a big day out. You know, you might make a mistake or two. So, so they got shot down, and you know, a couple of guys did fly into the ground, as far as, you know, so, and that's all part, it comes back to my sort of slightly brutal view of, you know, if we thought somebody just flown into the ground, I sort of sit back and think, again, brutally think, well, I'm not going to do that. I know I'm not going to do that, so I'm not going to worry about that. So that was my sort of mental thing going on there.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, from an RAF perspective, it was so huge at the time. I remember finishing at IOT. When did we finish? It was around the May time, wasn't it? I did.
Not for Dunk.
Dunk went back for a little more.
He definitely knew that, Dunk, when he said that.
Dunk stayed on for advanced courses, or what happened?
I had a smile halfway through that Dunk will have noticed. you know, I remember going to the Mildenhall Air Show after that, or in and around that sort of period. And all the desert aeroplanes there, a bunch of you guys up, and, you know, autographs like you read about. And again, pre-internet, but getting stories face to face. Then I mentioned this last week, I did the Combat Survival Rescue Officers course where John Peters gave a chat there, because we wanted to hear about what it was like on the ground. And I'd said last week, I mean, as you know, he's very good at that, how he tells the story. Rupert's the same. Both of them are on this. And you could hear a pin drop of everyone around the room wondering what it would have been like had I been in their shoes, or if I'd have been in your shoes, you know, looking at that wall of lead on night one. You know, I mentioned before, I've seen little puffs of AAA during the day. It didn't look scary to me in the stands. But a wall of lead that you guys are heading to, unbelievable. Definitely, JB, you mentioned the Tornado Force, but you know, I guess you guys were after that, but Nick mentioned it. Very soon after that, the F-4 went, the Buccaneer went. Lots of different aeroplanes disappeared, and the Tornado Force were still there and had that legacy of performing as well as they did in that first Gulf War and subsequently to then. And I think, you know, the fact that every Tornado crew got from that first Gulf War and still got all the way through to the end when they were operating in Afghanistan and Iraq, right to when they shut down last year, the year before. Nick and the team set the bar. Right then. Yeah.
Well, I think as well, the other thing, I mean, I'm sure you remember this as well, Godders, but that TVAM video that everyone can see on YouTube, should you wish to go there, they showed it. I remember I sat in Whittle Hall, which was effectively the big lecture hall at Cranwell, and they showed that video. Were you there as well, Godders? Do you remember that?
I must have been, but there's a lot of things I don't remember.
That to me was inspirational stuff, you know, that the journalists had put, it was all of the jets taking off from Bahrain, the big carrots coming out of the back of the jet in reheat as they go off. And I remember having that feeling of, you know, I want to, bit stupidly probably by the sounds of things talking to you, but I want to be there. That's what I want to do. You know, that was inspirational stuff to someone that had just joined the Air Force to hopefully become a fast jet pilot. And, you know, so I thought it was astounding to see. And it was you know, clearly all of the media coverage that's been going on recently, and rightly so, because it was a huge deal for the RAF.
And Parky, I mean, genuine question. I mean, you guys were doing a job. We didn't know how far Scuds were going to be shot. We didn't know, you know, any aircraft that were going to fly out to Cyprus. You've got to have all of these defences in place. You know, certainly I was in charge a few years ago of the defence of Cyprus when we first went into Syria. What was the feeling amongst you guys from, you know, seeing all of this going on? It must have been a real wrench being out there and you know, not being part of it.
Being far behind the line.
I started with a genuine question there, Duncan.
I knew it was coming. It's a regular theme, I would say. It was. I mean, we deployed from Germany as well, and at the time there was brief talk, a bit like, you know, Nick was saying, Plan A to Plan G, you know, in a day, and we were going to go to Turkey and sort of from the north and do some stuff there, air defence. And then it would change, and it was Cyprus with a view of going forward. And then I think it was as much politically as well. They wanted the F3, the air defence tornado, to be doing it. Yeah. And again, those boys were, you know, a few miles behind the ground attack. I accept that. So it was absolutely. I remember vividly, you know, just the boys coming through, and we had all the Phantoms were all just sort of on the line, and we were doing our alert. But you know, by then we realised it wasn't really going to happen for us. And then just seeing all the boys and the dissipated jets and all the, you know, a bit of feeling missing out, to be honest. You know, it was big at the time. It was huge. And, you know, we were very proud of the boys, you know, sort of coming back. And, you know, we tried to play it cool, but we were all, you know, here's what's it like. And just listening to, you know, what Nick said, just, you know, those boys did it. What was it like? You know, and just hearing your story, Nick, just unbelievable. It's been brilliant.
And Godders, have you got any? I know we've been talking for nearly 2 hours, haven't we? Yes. But
but it's not our normal mundane chat, so it's okay.
Sorry, JB, say that again.
It's not our normal mundane chat, so it's okay.
I know, not the banal.
I purposely didn't put anything out to because I knew we'd have a million questions we'd ask on the way through, and we would, you know, chat this long, so I purposely didn't put it out. So hopefully this will be a surprise for both listeners. Nick has given up his valuable time and what has been, I mean, flipping amazing story. You know, all of us have done stuff in the last 30 years, but listening to you talk about that as if it was yesterday, and to me it kind of was yesterday watching it on the telly and around with Duncan.
I mean, there's probably another 2 hours where I could rattle on about. There's all sorts of things I haven't talked about yet. There's two more low-level missions, which were, you know, the third one in particular went really, really bad. But it's an hour in itself, you know. So
there's a teaser.
Yeah. A re-attack.
Brilliant.
Come back in another 30 years, I'll tell you that one.
But, no, Nick, it's been a pleasure. And, you know, a huge thank you for coming on and talking like you have done. And I'll go to sleep tonight dreaming of that. I mean, for clearly people listening, they couldn't see that Nick had put his fingers crossed in front of each other.
Yes, I appreciate it.
Wall of lead.
Oh, yes. I never thought of that.
Yeah, with the wall of lead rolling through the as he rolled through the airfield. And just fantastic what you guys did. And, you know, I think we all take our hats off to you.
Yes. There we are. I mean, I do sort of say that. Look, we were not handpicked or anything. We would just have to be the guys there at the time. And as I say, any of you could have been there. It was just circumstances where it dictated that I was there. And, you know, and there we are. So I've always had some good stories to dine off over the last few years.
Well, Nick, that's been absolutely fantastic. I think we'll leave it there. I mean, that was pretty cool and pretty unusual for the sort of stuff which we do. You can find us on Twitter at what is the Twitter account again? Godders?
Pilot Episodes Pod.
Pilot Episodes Pod. I keep on forgetting that. So from me, Godders, Dunk, and Parky, and of course a massive thank you to Nick. Goodbye, and see you in maybe a month or so. About that. All right. Goodbye.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.